The court will proceed to the second case of the day, Jolly Group versus Medline Industries. Mr. Revelle.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Michael Revelle, and I'm here today representing myself, seeking to vacate an award of sanctions that was issued against me pursuant to Section 1927 and to salvage a reputation which I worked a lifetime to achieve. To me, the law has been much more than a jealous mistress. It has been my life. So it is particularly galling to be charged with disrespect for an institution that I've revered since I was in the sixth grade. Chief Judge Flom, speaking for this court in the Norm Brake case, said that sanctions under Section 1927 must be strictly construed. The reason is that there, for a rigorous standard, is a societal interest in having free access to the court, clients being able to obtain counsel in difficult cases, and for lawyers to be able to zealously represent their clients. The district court here, rather than strictly construing Section 1927, broadly construed it. At page 8 of the opinion, the district court said that the actions alone may not be sanctionable, but overall sanctions were appropriate, in her opinion. In other words, the whole was greater than the sum of the parts, and I suggest to you that that is a broad construction rather than a strict construction. The magistrate judge had their own classification under Section 1927 of a subject which she called deplorable sloppiness. The deplorable sloppiness in this case was a collating error of an exhibit. The correct exhibit was identified in the complaint, but unfortunately the wrong exhibit was attached. I've been ravaged by diabetes, and my eyesight has been severely impaired. You can see how big I have to have the type here to even see my own notes. Inadvertently, the wrong exhibit was attached.
Well, one of the problems was this with respect to the initial complaint, and I believe you acknowledged that you had some concerns about the statute of fraud. Why didn't you resolve those concerns before filing?
Well, I thought that we satisfied the statute of frauds by the writings that we had attached. And ultimately, the district court and the magistrate judge and the district court found that the theory in which I proceeded was plausible. We believed, and I believe still, that by saying that there was an agreement, and we factually had a basis to say that the parties had agreed, the fact that they weren't able to get their agreement in a written form, which was acceptable to both of them, doesn't vitiate the fact that there was an oral agreement. And under the statute of frauds, all you need is a writing charged by the signed by the person whom you sought to be charged. And we had those. We had about four or five of those. Those were looked at by the district court as separate contracts. They weren't. They were different. There were different writings and expressions of what was two or three contracts, which were modified. So, and that was not the basis upon which sanctions were ultimately awarded in any event. The other example of deplorable sloppiness, according to the magistrate judge, was that we mistook a 5 for an 8 in a handwritten document that was typed over May 6th, was read as May 18th, when in fact was August 18th. When it was pointed out to us in a footnote in the opposition to the motion to dismiss, we disavowed that document. We said they may be right, and therefore we're not going to rely on that document. And later, when I believed that they were right, I sought to amend the complaint to delete that allegation, because we had planned on appealing to this court, and I didn't want to go up on a complaint which had in it an allegation of fact which I then knew to be untrue. Now, the purpose of Section 1927 is to avoid multiplicious and vexatious litigation. both of these alleged errors of deplorable sloppiness were contained in pleadings, which ultimately both the magistrate and the district court found were plausible and were hence proper. So there could be no multiplication of the proceeding, and there is no basis to award sanctions for this new classification of deplorable sloppiness. And on some basis, which is still unknown to me, the district court says, well, your argument that the mistake was made by your associate, not you, was disingenuous. There's affidavits from me and the associate. She was the one that had misread it. She was the one that originally put it in. I authorized the complaint. The magistrate and judge found I signed the complaint. If you look at the original complaint, I didn't. There's a stamped signature. I'm not trying to back away from it, but I don't think I should be tarred with bad faith on the basis of an error which was made in determining whether something was a 5 or something which was an 8, and we immediately, when it was called to our attention, backed away from it. If anything, I think it shows good faith rather than bad faith.
Mr. Revelle, did Judge Conlon limit the sanction to the second amended complaint or to these mistakes? I'm not absolutely clear. Are you suggesting, though, it seems to me she limited it to the filing of the second amended? You're saying she reached back, or the magistrate did, to the mistakes?
I don't know. The magistrate judge said that she thought that sanctions were appropriate here because of the filing of the motion to reconsider,
right,
and the filing of the second amended complaint, and then went on to talk about what she called deplorable sloppiness. Now, whether that was a basis, which I took it to be, or whether that's just some further evidence of why she thought it was appropriate, I don't know. If it is a basis, it's an improper basis. And as to the filing of the motion for reconsideration, the district court judge decided this case initially on a ground that had not been briefed by either of the parties. So the motion to amend and the memorandum, including that for the amendment to the complaint, was only 7 pages in length. It was extremely short, and we pointed out the fact that we thought that the court was wrong in its analysis. And again, it had never been briefed prior to that. And the reason for the second amended complaint was there was a fear of waiver. And the waiver was that we had relied in the opposition to the motion to dismiss on 2 writings that technically were not part of the pleadings. And so it was not within the 4 corners of the document. So when we came up to this court, I wanted to have those documents in the record. And the only way that I could do it without being potentially faced with a waiver problem was to amend the complaint to include those documents. And that's what we said when we sought to amend the complaint. That's all we did, and correct the factual error. Again, I think that's something that should be done rather than something that one should be criticized for doing.
Let me you're trying to get out from under this sanction order, and in dollars, it's, I don't know, $1,500 or something,
yeah,
like that, probably. You're also in a situation where you have to defend against a claim for sanctions going over and above that considerably. What's a ballpark number here that would be sanctions awarded to the other side if it were to go back to the original filing of the complaint in this case?
Well, they had requested before the magistrate judge approximately $60,000. They told Judge Conlon originally that the number was $30,000, but when it came down to actually put a number on it, the number they put in was roughly $60,000, including $10,000 for Lexis and Westlaw charges. But I don't think that is even properly before this court, because they never objected to the magistrate judge's finding that the complaint and the amended complaint were plausible and appropriate and were within the bounds of advocacy. That being so, I think that argument is waived for this court, because it was never brought to the district court's attention after the magistrate judge ruled. I think I've covered that which I wanted to cover. If there's any questions by any of you, I'd be I won't say delighted, but I would be happy to answer them.
I guess not at this time. We'll reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Revelle. Mr. Hoffmeister?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Dan Hoffmeister on behalf of MedLight Industries. Your Honor, I'd like to dive directly into some of the questions that were raised during Mr. Revelle's time before you. First, there is nowhere in this record that either the magistrate judge or the district court judge indicated that Mr. Revelle's complaints, multiple, had any plausibility at all. In fact, it's quite the opposite. When we look back to the April order by Judge Conlon, that order specifically states that I'm dismissing this with prejudice, that the documents in which you have attached, at least to the original complaint and then the amended complaint, though those were sort of switched out, calculated in a calculated way, the documents in your very hands prove you have no cause of action. It proves that when you look at the statute of fraud, which Judge Williams appropriately pointed out earlier, he knew. He knew even before the filing of the complaint, it's in his own affidavit, that the statute of frauds was a serious problem for him and his client, and that he had to address that, but he could not. And it, the very documents, the drafting back and forth regarding this contract show that. In fact, when you read down his complaints, all of them, even with the switching out of evidence and the deleting of exhibits and the generic treatment of certain allegations in the former complaint or in the latter complaints, you can see that by his very own allegations, on its face, there is no cause of action that he has. It's just simply not there. So there is nowhere in this record any plausible cause of action. What was sanctioned here was the conduct after the dismissal of the amended complaint, getting to your question, Judge, that is where the court limited itself. And you're right, it is a bit confusing when you look at the district court's order. What happened was she was under a misapprehension of the law as to how far she could extend the sanctions. When you look at the magistrate's order as well as the magistrate's report as well as the district court's order, particularly when you look back to the findings of the district court's June 4th order, which is superheated, to say the least, about Mr. Revelle's conduct, you can see that those were wrapped into a discussion of the sanctionable conduct that Mr. Revelle had done throughout the case. But the district court and the magistrate felt that they could not look back because there was amending that had to be done, and that was obvious. But what it did not take into account was the TCI decision by this court. And the TCI decision versus Needler and Associates makes clear that from the beginning, under Rule 11, an attorney has an obligation to not only know the facts and to plead accurate facts, but to know the law before you file a complaint, not afterwards.
But to get sanctions under Rule 11, the judge dismissed the case too soon for that, didn't he?
That's correct.
I think it's partly because you filed a motion to dismiss the day after you served your Rule 11 letter.
Well, I think part of it is when you look at the docket, you'll see that we had to file our motion to dismiss to be timely in that time frame. We also, starting from the beginning, it's not from a professional standpoint, we sent a Rule 11 letter, and it was multiple pages. It was detailed. It laid everything out that we argued all the way to today to try to give Mr. Revelle a complete and utter heads up that you cannot do this. You know better. You have a history as a lawyer that should not be tarnished by taking these actions. But he chose to do it anyway, and he did it in a calculated way. when you look, study, when you really get down to the details of what exhibits were moved out, what language and allegations became generic versus that of specific in the earlier complaints, you can see the pattern. It's very clear that the exhibits that are removed are those that are hurting his case and that he's got to take care of them. He should have known that from the beginning because he has them in his hands, but he didn't. But when we point it out to him and do his work for him, then he tries to scramble and correct the errors. But the errors are uncorrectable, as the court points out. Even in the court's order in April, she points out specifically, the writings relied on by Jolly, the initial draft of the mail-in signed May 18th, which is actually August 18th, that was an untruth, and subsequent, the red line modification contract belied the existence of a contract and its terms and conditions. Indeed, the writings reveal an obvious disagreement between the contract's essential terms. That's the basis of this. You've got drafting going back and forth with the mirror image rule here in Illinois, which is not something that's new. We can see very clearly that you just did not pay attention to the law. For example, when we look at the TCI decision by this court, the language that this court has put forth, and this was some 20 years ago, indicates that lawyers sometimes file first and think later. It goes on to state that this may impose on the other party the cost of deciphering the pleadings, running down the cases, informing the court, and putting things right. That's exactly what happened here. Medline had to do the work. Yes, thousands of dollars of work to set things right. And, again, gave Mr. Rovell every opportunity to stop. He could have withdrawn his amended complaint. He could have stopped what was taking place. But then, to another point that was raised with the court, he indicates that he disavowed the May 18th, August 18th debate, that when he was informed on multiple occasions by Medline that was completely untrue, that it was actually signed on August 18th. In fact, when it's signed on August 18th, like it actually was, that proves his case even more inept and completely implausible. That shows that his partial performance arguments under the statute of frauds just did not happen in a timely manner. So even if he could make that argument with a straight face, which he couldn't, taking that truth, that date, August 18th, into play, it completely wipes out his theories, even beyond what we're already in trouble. The important point from a sanctions point of view is that he, in his opposition to the sanctions motions and other motions, argued and defended his position that the May 18th date was a true fact and that the district court had to rely on it in a motion to dismiss context. That's wrong. It continues to be wrong. And he's still here before the Seventh Circuit arguing that, well, it wasn't until later that I tried to correct that error. Well, it was an error, but it should have been corrected much before that. And it was a known error. It's just reading the contract.
So, Mr., could you just give me a little help on the procedural history? I'm trying to track it through the sheet that's attached. Were there sanctioned proceedings before the District Judge Conlon, and then a referral to the magistrate?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
Yeah,
okay.
Let me walk through that for you.
Yeah, if you would.
Sure, no problem. The complaint was filed in December of 2003. Then there was a motion to dismiss a couple of months later by us. Then they filed an amended complaint. They didn't even try to keep the original complaint going. Then there was the amended complaint in March of 2004. Then we issued a Rule 11 letter to him, as I indicated earlier, on March 25th. Then there was a motion to dismiss the amended complaint, and then we moved for Rule 11 sanctions as well as 1927 sanctions shortly thereafter. Then he opposed that, some of the things that we had indicated. Then the court, without hearing argument, just taking it on the papers, which, again, we believe that that would have been appropriate, and I think the court would agree with us, but she felt that procedurally she wanted to give him a hearing. give him an opportunity to explain his actions because they were so egregious. And it was just a procedural move on Judge Conlon's part to allow Mr. Rovell to speak to these issues in open court, even beyond the multiple pages of briefing, which I'm sure you've been put before you. I know it was put before you in the record. And then she gave him that hearing and then referred it to the magistrate.
All right, now that's what I want to gather.
Sure.
So we have a district judge confronted with a request for sanctions.
Yes.
She hears argument on that?
She does. She makes her ruling, and then on the motion to reconsider, then she says, on motion to reconsider, what we're going to do is we're going to give him a hearing on this. And then after the hearing, she said, I'm going to vacate just my conclusions. She did not. Pages 1 through 7 of her original June 4th order, which details all of Mr. Rovell's egregious conduct, which she considers to be frivolous actions, etc., she makes clear that those 7 pages are the findings and that she combed the record. But she said, I'm going to send this to the magistrate.
For what reason?
Well, she wanted him to find out. Well, I need to back up. We were before the magistrate right after the sanctions order because she wanted to know how much. So the issue of what the sanctions were going to be before the magistrate, as Mr. Rovell indicated, we exchanged documentation back and forth, and we had indicated we provided him his bills. In fact, we talked about those with the magistrate to a limited degree. So the numbers were back and forth, and
so
everybody knew.
It went to the magistrate basically for math.
Yes, it went to the magistrate for her.
Not to analyze any sanctions.
Initially. Then there's the motion for reconsideration before the court. Court says, I need to give you a hearing. And then there's a hearing, and she says, well, I'm going to.
Who's, and she says, you say, and then she says, there's a hearing. She conducts the hearing, Judge Conlon?
Yes, she does. She conducts the hearing. She keeps in place all of her findings from her previous hearing on the motion. And she said, but I'm going to strike the conclusions now. I'm going to let the magistrate look at this and give me a report, and then we'll circle back to this.
So you have a district judge who's had a hearing on sanctions?
Yes.
About an attorney's conduct where she's been monitoring it, and then she refers it to a magistrate to rehear any possible sanctions? In your view, is the district judge seeking to find from the magistrate's perspective about a case she's been monitoring at the district court level? What kind of hearing is to be had? It sounds to me, is that a second hearing on the matters that was heard by her originally, her meaning Judge Conlon?
It was, in a sense, and it was a bit confusing because even the magistrate, and I understand your concern because it's confusing to us as well. The magistrate was given an opportunity to look at and rely upon, and in fact she wrote in her report that she's relying on the first 6 or 7 pages that were not vacated by Judge Conlon, her findings, and that she was now charged by Judge Conlon to look at this matter in light of those and then to issue a rule and recommendation.
Doesn't that strike you as a little odd that a magistrate would review sanctions that were found to be needed by the district court? I mean, was she taking new evidence, the magistrate?
No, she just took argument. And again, we briefed it further, and I really think it was an exercise to make sure that the record was as complete as possible because Mr. Rovell made a concerted effort to argue unconstitutionality and then notice issues and the like. And I think both courts below, particularly Judge Conlon, wanted to just take that argument away. I'm going to give him every opportunity, even if we have to double up, if you will, and redo the hearings. I'm just going to give him every opportunity to explain himself because this conduct is so egregious and so deplorable. When you look at the magistrate's report after these hearings, as well as Judge Conlon's report, you look at the language in which they use. It's clearly vexatious and unreasonable, needlessly prolonging litigation, extremely negligent, reckless, and indifferent conduct, compounded transgression, bad faith, deplorable sloppiness, disingenuous, cannot duck blame so readily, failed to correct mistakes. Then the district court, even after the magistrate's report, says this: the claims clearly are not viable, which again flies in the face of what Mr. Rovell is indicating, that there's some plausibility here. There's never been a plausibility, and no court has ever said that. In addition, the district court went on to say the amended complaint was baseless. Just flat out baseless. Now, when you put that in light of TCI, that makes clear, as the court pointed out,
that when you are forcing the other side to do all of your work, to correct the record, to stop the mistakes, to cease frivolous litigation, then there are sanctions that are due under 1927, and that's what both of the magistrate and the district court found. It's not that they didn't find sanctions. They certainly did. Their issue was, I don't know if I can look back after the amended complaint. In fact, they said when the dismissal order took place, that's our dividing line. And that was an artificial dividing line. When they read TCI, and if they would have taken that into account and not misapprehended it, it would have been clear to them in the language, which is very clear in TCI, that you don't get a free pleading. There are no free pleadings. This court can't afford to allow free pleadings. You can't throw things against the wall and hope they stick. That's not justice, and that's not this system. And that's what happened here. And it has to be stopped. And that's why more sanctions are required here to give 1927 any teeth whatsoever. The district court and the magistrate should be allowed to go back and understand under TCI that they can look at the complete picture, which they have detailed nicely, but they just misapprehended that they can go all the way back, because Mr. Rovell started this campaign of frivolous lawsuit from the beginning and has continued today.
If one were to examine the transcript of arguments before the magistrate mm-hmm. and the arguments before the district judge, are there any significant differences in the arguments presented?
No. I would say there's just more excuses, and I don't mean to be trite about that. Mr. Rovell, again, trying to explain away the actions that have taken place, but the pleadings are the pleadings. And again, they're on the face, and there's no explanation for those things, and as much as you run and hide from them, they're just glaring. And the district court and the magistrate's language makes that clear. In addition, I'm sorry, I think my time's up.
You may finish your thought.
Okay. In addition to TCI, what also is made clear in the Cronshaw case, that again, the law in the Seventh Circuit has been and is that you do not get a free pleading, that you have to conduct yourself pursuant to the mandates of Rule 11. That did not happen here. The sanctions that are required here are much more than $1,500 or so in light of this egregious conduct of Mr. Rovell. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffmeister. Mr. Rovell.
It seems Mr. Hoffmeister and I must have been in different cases. The district court originally, in her original order, found sanctions going all the way back to the filing of the complaint. She granted sanctions without ever having a hearing or any opportunity to explain. That she could not constitutionally do. That was the subject of a motion to vacate her decision. She recognized, I believe, implicitly, that she couldn't do it, and that's the reason she vacated the sanctions, and that's the reason it went down to the magistrate judge, so that the meaningful opportunity to be heard would be heard rather than on a motion to reconsider. And again, no good deed goes unpunished, because in the motion to vacate, I specifically said, vacate from pages 7 onward. That's where the findings were against me, pages 1 through 6 of the award related to the motion for reconsideration. And since the case was going to go up on appeal, I thought it was important for this court, even though the ruling was against me, for this court to know what it was that was the district court's reasoning as to why the motion to reconsider was denied. I did not think for a moment that on one hand she would vacate the findings from pages 7 on, and those same findings on pages 1 through 6 should continue to withstand vitality. That makes no sense whatsoever. And so the district court judge, I don't think, meant those findings to be to continue on as it relates to me. Chief Judge Parsons in Hill versus Norfolk very eloquently said in a dissenting opinion regarding sanctions when a court orders them with a lawyer not having an opportunity to respond, and he said, and I quote, "The unmonitored act of assessing sanctions against a lawyer can too easily beget emotion. It is a common human tendency to find self-assurance and anger when punishing, and that drive for self-assurance itself has to enhance the level of the punishment. In the performance of the judicial function, the court, like any other person in authority, can too easily lose sight of its otherwise dispassionate review of the facts and the law when it considers, without a prior exchange of reasoning, an assessment of sanctions. And I think those thoughts apply in full force here. Some of the things that were said by Judge Conlon were a result of her not hearing the other side. And when she heard those other sides, those things were wrong. And she had a chance, if she wanted to give sanctions going all the way back to the original complaint, to do that when she got back the magistrate's recommendations. The magistrate's recommendation says, no, your legal theories on the amended complaint and the regular complaint had not been rejected. Section 1927 sanctions on that basis is not appropriate. That's page 14 of the magistrate judge's recommendations. I think it's at page 75 in the appendix as well. So that's the basis on which I say that plausibility was found. The magistrate judge says, look, I'm not going to relitigate whether you were right or wrong as to the merits. That's been decided against you. But the issue of plausibility had not been decided by the district court, because it was there to decide whether or not there was a claim, not whether the claim was plausible. That only came up on the sanctions. And on that one, ultimately, I prevailed. And the mirror image rule doesn't apply as it relates to these pleadings at this point. The mirror image rule is whether or not an agreement has been reached. Factually, we argued that there was an agreement. Had they filed an answer and denied it, had they moved for summary judgment or at trial, then the things that relate to the mirror image rule would become relevant. But not at the beginning stage where there's a factual allegation that an agreement in fact had been made. We cited the cases that supported that legal theory. Is it a difficult case? Yes. But we don't sanction people because they take difficult cases. And in taking this difficult case, I think it's important for this court to recognize and understand I took no discovery. I didn't file any motions to produce documents. I didn't file any interrogatories. I took no depositions. I sat on my hands waiting for the motion to dismiss to be decided. If it was against me, the case was over. I could have tried to vexatiously multiply the case by running up their fees. I didn't do that. I voluntarily did not do that. Now, he says I was switching things in and out to try to shore up the complaint. That's simply untrue. I deleted an exhibit because I didn't need it under Illinois law. I didn't need the allegations either. I left those allegations in because he was making the argument as to the mirror image rule, and I wanted to be candid and leave the case as much as it was before as afterwards. And he himself admitted in the argument before the magistrate judge that, yes, by my leaving that in, which I didn't have to do, he was able to make his argument as to the mirror image rule. So at every stage I have tried in this case and every other case before this court and every other court in this land to zealously represent a client within the bounds of the professionalism. I know where the line is. I didn't even come close to crossing the line. It's very easy to engage in rhetoric. It's especially easy to engage in rhetoric when you're defenseless and people are making these accusations and you didn't even have an opportunity to respond until after the award was made against you.
I just have one quick question. I mean, in light of your health problems and these issues, have you put anything in your law office to avoid these kinds of problems in the future?
I'm more cognizant of them. The problem with my eyes happened originally 2 weeks before this complaint was originally filed. I didn't recognize it at the time. 2 days before the complaint was filed, I was at the Bascom-Palmer Clinic in Miami. Again, I didn't realize how bad it was. My eyesight has continued to deteriorate. And maybe I've stayed at the dance too long. I don't know. I hope not. I think there's still a few good years left in me.
Well, I was just hopeful something could be done that would avoid this problem in the future. And
people make, you know, people make mistakes. I don't think I have miscollated anything from December of 2003 onward. At least if I have, it hasn't been called to my attention, and I am unaware of it. But I am more cognizant of my deficiencies than I had been before.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Revelle. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.